I have Heidi Schuster with me today, so I'm going to read Heidi's bio for you. So Heidi is a nutrition and body image therapist, somatic experiencing practitioner, clinical supervisor, and embodiment warrior who speaks and writes about whole self wellness. She has practiced in the Boston area for nearly 30 years and is the author of the award-winning book, Nourish, How to Heal Your Relationship with Food, Body, and Self, and the new book, Nurture, How to Raise Kids Who Love Food, Their Bodies, and Themselves. Heidi is a lifelong dancer, a plant lady, and the proud mama of two outrageous young women. Welcome, Heidi, to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Victoria.
I'm excited to get started. Shall we start with 10 quick fire questions?
Sure.
All right, let's go.
I guess so.
I mean, I say quick. Some of them aren't quick, but we'll give it your best.
Okay, great.
If you could have any animal as a pet, mythical or real, what would it be and why?
Wow. That's such a great question. I would say that I would love to have a winged horse as a pet. I think that would be fun because I remember as a child at camp really liking being on a horse, and then the wings would just add to it. Yeah.
With you on that one. Flying horse, that's a unicorn, right?
I mean, it could have a horn, sure. But like as long as it has wings, I guess it could be a Pegasus then, right? If it just has wings.
That's it. Yeah. Favorite food?
Favorite food? It's a tie between mango and chocolate.
Oh, what about mango chocolate?
That would be amazing.
If you could master any instrument overnight, what would it be and why?
I have always wanted to play the violin, and maybe someday I will, but I wish I had learned it as a young person because I love it so much.
Beautiful, right? Can't play the violin. What's the funniest or most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to you in public?
Wow. What is the funniest thing? I wish I had a really good story that I could just pull. Actually, I don't know if it was like, I guess it was very embarrassing and it could have been painful, but I used to be a stilt performer. And one time I was in a parade and I fell, and it was like, it was not dangerous. Like I was fine, but it was more humiliating because, you know, the last thing you want to do when you're in a parade, making everyone smile, is to have them all go,
I bet so. They laughed when they knew you were okay though.
Yes. Yeah, it was fine.
That's a good share, that one.
Yeah. You like learn how to fall correctly when you do that for a while.
Yeah. I can imagine. Wow. Okay, if you could only listen to one song for the rest of your life, which one would it be?
Oh, that would drive me crazy if I could only listen to one song over and over and over again. So I don't know if I'd want to listen to anything over
That's
and over,
the
because
point.
I think my brain would just implode. That's my answer.
Good answer. All right. Oh, what's the most adventurous thing you've ever eaten, and did you like it?
Wow. I'm probably not as adventurous as a lot of listeners, actually, in terms of I haven't traveled to like too many exotic places. But I have had like, I think it was alligator tail, and I actually was pretty good.
Oh, interesting.
Tasted like chicken. Like really, it did taste like chicken.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Next one. Where's your favorite place to go on holiday or vacation?
I like to go someplace new. If I had a choice, I'd want to go someplace I'd never been before. But in terms of places that I've been to that I really want to go back to, I would say it's Italy and Scotland.
I'm from Scotland. My surname was, before I was married, was Scottish.
Oh, like where in Scotland are you from?
Well, when I say I'm from Scotland, my ancestors are. I didn't live there.
Yeah,
My
gotcha.
ancestors, so I don't know.
Well, I just went there for the first time about a year and a half ago and just like fell in love with the Highlands. It's just so beautiful and remote. And yeah, it's just amazing.
It's
So
stunning. Okay, what's the weirdest job you've ever had or heard of someone having?
The weirdest job I've ever had is probably my still performing job, actually. Like, for a long time, I worked for a stilt troupe and got hired to dance around for children and park events and parades on stilts. And it was a lot of fun.
Awesome. Okay, two left. What's your favorite smell?
My favorite smell is jasmine.
Oh, yes, love that. And last one, what would you like to what would you like people to take away from this conversation we're about to have?
Well, I would love, I mean, I'm promoting my brand new book, so of course
Please
I'd love to
do.
talk about my
Love your
book.
way.
Because that's
Please
just
do.
what you do when you're promoting launching a book is you talk about it. But I want to talk about it because I actually feel really passionate about the contents, which is like changing the conversations about food and bodies with the next generation. So.
So important. So let's dive straight in then with, I mean, my listeners know I look at my notes. Sometimes I ask the questions that you know is coming. Sometimes I don't, depends where my intuition takes me. However, big question, how can families support their children? I know it's such a big question, to have a healthy relationship with food and their bodies.
Yes, it's such a big question. I wrote like 10 different chapters on it. So I think there's like, I came up with 10 different like items that families can work on, families and caregivers can work on, anyone who works with children. And some of it is about how we talk about food. I think there's so much morality around food in the world. And I think the more neutral and joyful and relaxed we can be around food with children, the better, because there's so much of this like nervous morality about eating in the world. And then when it comes to talking about bodies, the same, like being neutral and like accepting and comfortable talking about bodies is, I think, also incredibly helpful.
So, I mean, I'm not a mum, but I work with a lot of mothers. And so I know that whatever the mother does, they're modeling the behavior for the child, even if the mother or any parent, you know, parent or caretaker is saying something different to the child. Let's say they're saying, you know, your body's, depending on what age the child is, like your body's great, all bodies are beautiful. That type of stuff. But then the parent is perhaps hiding from the mirror or criticizing themselves in front of the mirror or having like body language of like not fully accepting in front of the mirror. The children pick up on that more than what the words that we tell them.
Absolutely. They're watching. And they're watching sometimes more closely than we think they are, too. And so if you're saying disparaging things about your own body, then it's confusing for children because they're looking at their parents who are their role models, you know, until they bring other role models into their life and should, but their parents are like their primary role models. And if mom is just saying disparaging things about her body, then wait, I might look like mom someday. So is she saying something also negative about my body? Perhaps. I think it gets confusing for kids. So I think the more we can be neutral and accepting, and comfortable in our own skin, you know, easier said than done. Sometimes we have to do our own work as parents first and foremost, I think the better. And then we give kids a more neutral palette to work with.
I remember seeing a Dove, you know, the brand Dove who do like skincare and things. I remember seeing one of their like campaigns, I think it was a couple of years ago, and it was mind-blowing really, and quite heartfelt and also upsetting. They had all these different children, I think, have you seen it, of different ages? And then mm-hmm. if they interviewed their mother separately and the children separately, and their mother would be like, oh, I don't like my legs or whatever it was. And the little children said the same thing, just in a different way about their bodies, but also with positive ways that their parent, the mother would speak to herself. The child also would pick up on that, and then it all internalize everything and make it about their bodies as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is amazing. And, you know, one of the things that I struggled with when I was writing this book for our parents, and I am a parent, I have two currently almost 19-year-olds who are off in college, but I, you know, and they're young women, and I have like struggled with this myself, not because I certainly, like, working in the field of eating disorders for almost 30 years, I certainly knew that I needed to sort of have that communication. But yet every once in a while, I would say something too. And I wrote about it in my book that like one time my daughter called me on saying something like negative about my small chest. And she was sort of like, Mom, like, own it. We're in the itty bitty titty committee together. And I was like, okay, like busted, you know, like, so, yeah. You know, kids really do, like really do want those positive messages around their bodies and your body and bodies in general. Yeah. And so I, you know, I think as a writer, I was trying to sort of communicate the fact that like, even though I have done so much work in this field and sort of know what to say, even I can slip. Mm-hmm. Like we're human beings and we're in this culture that is so like image focused and image driven that we, you know, we're bumbling along trying to be good parents. And even we can sometimes make a mistake in terms of our, and I think we have to just roll with that and give ourselves some grace.
Yeah. Like you say, we're only human and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact she said, own it, because I love the phrase own it, otherwise it will own you.
Mm-hmm.
If you own the shit out of whatever it is that you're not liking about yourself, then you have a whole different energy level and confidence and acceptingness. If that's right. Not a word, I've made it a word, acceptingness.
Right. I like that. Yeah. And I'm you know, I'm always proud of the things that I hear young people say today, that are much more accepting and open and inclusive than, let's say, how I was raised in the 70s and the 80s, when we're much more narrow-minded around bodies. So I do feel like things are changing, although I do think we have, you know, more work to do.
Yeah, I agree with that. For sure. And we're here doing the work and spreading the love, and it all starts with us, right? In order to show our children, and I say, you know, not metaphorically for me, in order to show our children that it's okay to fully accept who we are and love ourselves, we first need to do that and practice that every day for us first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even if you don't have children, you're encountering young mm-hmm. people all the time. And so I think that body confidence and that body presence and acceptance is really important. And of course, a major point that I have always wanted to make is that our bodies are just one aspect of who we are as a human being. I know you agree with me there, that like we don't want to put too much importance on the body with our children, because it's just one aspect of who we are.
Yeah. Love that. Let's go into kind of food, the food conversation then. So if a child won't eat quote unquote healthy foods, like won't eat the vegetables, won't eat the greens, and they're picky eaters, how do parents navigate that without, you know, building up this is good, this is bad, you're not allowed to leave the table or have dessert till you finish? Like I see that even with my sister's children, and I'm taking a step back. It's not my children, but I can see now I'm in this work, so much problematic language around food. So how do we navigate that if you've got a picky eater or a child that won't eat greens or healthy things?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, I like to try not to categorize food into healthy and unhealthy. Just keep it really neutral with children so that, because, well, sometimes it backfires to call something healthy, right?
Yes.
And that, like, they want to just, if mom wants me to eat this food, then I'm going to exert my independence and not eat it. So I think we have to be careful about categorizing foods in general. And then if you do have a child who's picky, which, you know, some children go through picky phases. And again, I'm stressing here that it's mostly a phase. Often it's about them being cautious in general, or cautious about different textures or flavors or colors that they're just not used to. And so it's most of the time, if the child is exposed to the food repeatedly. In fact, the intern who I worked on this book with, she did a bunch of research for me and found that we have to try things 13 to 30 times. Some children may need to try something 13 to 30 times before it's accepted into their palates. Obviously things that are maybe like more complicated texture or flavor. And so some of that is just exposure and time. And I think if parents are nonchalant about it and not like creating, not having too much emotion about it, then the child isn't going to develop too much emotion about it either. And they're more likely to maybe try it next time. So I think some of the challenge comes when the parent kind of steps over into the child's lane and is then either trying to force them to eat certain things or force them to eat things in a certain order. And the child, as they're exerting their newfound independence at different stages, might say, no, I'm not going to do that. You want to not have food be the place where they exert their independence. So keeping things like neutral and fun and light in general will help.
So what would that look like then? Would it look like having dessert if, you know, the family chooses to have dessert on the table at the same time as like the dinner? Like, how would that look? How would it look like practically?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually was one of those parents who did that, and it worked out fine in my household. And my kids don't have a particularly charged relationship around sweet things. In fact, one of my daughters is like really doesn't like sweet things much at all. Maybe one particular kind of sweet thing, and that's about it. So that worked out for us, but that doesn't always work for every household, especially if sweets have already become charged. It might be that sometimes you serve dessert and sometimes you don't. And again, being nonchalant about it. If the child is jumping up and down and saying, I want ice cream, to just say, we're not going to have ice cream tonight, but we might have it later this week. And just nonchalantly, not with a lot of emotion. Or like, you know, if there are certain foods that have already become charged, like in the household, let's say some like cookies or something have become charged, then you like set some reasonable limits around them so that there's a like a portion that everyone in the household can abide by that gets served, including the adults. And I think it's really important that siblings not be treated differently when it comes to food, where some siblings get like full access to all the snacks and treats they want and some don't. I think that can be really problematic. But in general, if you do need to set some limits, I'm a big fan of almost no limits around food. But if it doesn't work in your household because there are already some dynamics there around food and portions and charge, then like setting some reasonable limits that the whole household can follow makes sense. And the limit itself isn't important. It's more just the attitude about it and the fact that it's consistent.
Yeah. So that would not look like, and you know, me and my mom have had in-depth conversations about this, and she was only doing the best she knew with what she was taught, right? Yes. I would be told time and time again from such a young baby, if you're really good, then you can have some chocolate. Or I'm crying, oh, don't cry, here's some chocolate. Oh, and it would be a whole exciting treat kind of thing. And food was used as a reward. And that's not helpful, is it?
I don't recommend it. No, I like let the child, you know, be excited about their success with potty training. They don't need to have like a treat as a result of that. You know, I agree. I think setting up food as a reward can be problematic ultimately. Yeah. I don't think it's like completely damaging, but I do think that it makes food more connected to other, like maybe connected to dopamine, maybe connected to, you know, sort of positives and negatives in general. Whereas I really prefer that like food be treated more neutrally in general.
Yeah.
I think that's like the best way to go.
Yeah, because for me that led to, and that I'm glad I had the experience I had, because I wouldn't be where I am now, but that led to a lot of emotional eating that turned into binge eating. Because if I was only allowed sweets and chocolate when I was good, as a teenager or as an older adult, if I wasn't good, I would use that food for comfort and feel even worse because I didn't deserve it. And then the whole shame spiral would kind of continue. Whereas now I see chocolate was used to be my thing. Now chocolate's just chocolate. It's delicious, but it's not on a pedestal anymore. Whereas it used to be on a pedestal up until like a couple of years ago. I was like so excited for chocolate. And yeah, I look forward to posh, expensive chocolates on special occasions, but it's just chocolate and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. You and me both. I totally can resonate with that as well. Like, it, you know, food preferences are fine to like for children to have, but it's different when there's like a strong emotional and psychological charge around a particular food. And it's usually because that food has been taken away or used as a reward. So I think avoiding that situation as much as possible is ideal. That said, like you can only do so much in your household. Kids are going to be exposed to all different kinds of foods and feeding experiences pretty soon as they get older. So I do think the more neutral you can make food, the better. I've always found that the kids who came from sugar-free households, so on the flip side, like the parents are not allowing anyone to have chocolate or any kind of sweet, they would, when they came over to our house, because, you know, I was pretty open about things, they'd be like climbing for like the dusty Halloween candy that was there for like months that my kids was kind of done with after the first 2 days. So I do think there is something about keeping things pretty neutral, and like not going to the extreme of restricting too, as well as not using it as a reward.
Yes. And what about children who, and this is probably because there has been some, I like the word you use, charge, some charge around sweets and chocolate. Let's say a parent is listening to this and they want to take a more food freedom approach with their children because maybe they're on their own journey with food freedom and they're now starting to introduce, you know, sweets and chocolate more freely. Can we, I mean, I kind of, I know the answer to this question and I'm asking it for, you know, for a bigger reason. Can we trust our children to learn from the experience of perhaps eating quote unquote too much sweets and chocolate that they needed and not feeling great? Can we trust them to self-regulate depending on how old they are? Or do we need to always then have some boundaries in place? You know, see what I'm asking? It's not very clear.
I do see what you're asking. It's such a good question too. I think ultimately children are pretty good at self-regulating until like the adults kind of step in and interfere a little bit with that self-regulation, which is easy to do as a parent. I can, you know, I have a lot of compassion around that. But in general, children self-regulate pretty well. If they like overeat one type of food one day, they're likely to not eat it the next day. They kind of make up for those like times when they maybe eat sketchy because they're so busy on one day and they like maybe eat a little bit more the next day. They're really actually pretty good at self-regulating. But I think that particularly if there are some foods that have some charge, it's okay to set some limits too. So for example, you wouldn't like send a child into a candy store and say, have everything you want.
You
know, you probably give them like a little bag and say, here, you can fill this up, or here's a couple of dollars. You can spend this amount, and then give them that limit. For the most part, you know, that's reasonable. As they get older and they have some of their own spending money, for example, then they may go out to a candy store and eat too much. But then they have to have that experience and learn that, like, oh, okay, that was way too many jelly beans or whatever. That didn't feel good in my body. And if you notice that you have a child, for example, who's doing that, like sometimes kids will overeat to soothe or because they want the sensory input from the food. It's okay to sort of like ask your child, like, how does your body feel? Like, how does your belly feel? Because that brings them back to their own sense of being in their body and having the experience.
That's beautiful. I wish I learned that at a young age.
Same.
Well, here
but
we go.
You know, we're learning as we, you know, as we go along, and hopefully as adults we're like working on our own embodiment so that then we can communicate that to our kids and the next generation that we might spend time with.
And talking of like chocolate and candy, and for me that's pleasure as well as emotional nourishment. How important is it that children eat for pleasure as well as nourishment? And I guess this question kind of off the back of this is, if a child genuinely doesn't like something that's really supportive of their health, let's say broccoli, would you sneak that in things? Or like, how would you navigate that in terms of pleasure, nourishment, that type of conversation?
Yeah, I think pleasure is incredibly important. I'm a nutritionist, I'm a registered dietitian. So I do value good balanced nutrition, but I also value pleasure. And I think that's almost more important today, where there's just so much morality around what's healthy and what's not healthy to eat, that like in some ways we have to preserve the pleasure of eating for our children. So I think it's very important. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, it's
enough?
important for us too,
yeah.
I think, because we're told by, you know, diet culture and things like that. Even like, I don't know if you have Galaxy over there. It's like a brand of chocolate. I think you call it Dove, actually. In different places, it's called different things.
Okay.
There was an advert I remember when I was growing up. It was a bunny. So it was like a cartoon sexy bunny having this Galaxy. And then the slogan was guilty pleasure. So automatically, just from an advert, which is selling chocolate bars, you're linking pleasure to guilt. And
I know,
so,
it's a bummer.
Yeah, it is, right? And so it's almost like I can only have pleasure in chocolate if I've earned it by dieting all day or exercising, or other than just showing, I guess, ourselves and then our children that it's okay to have something pleasurable to eat just for the sake of it being pleasurable and enjoyable.
Right. Yeah. And it's too bad that there has to be guilt equated with that pleasure. There really doesn't. Like
No.
we should be enjoying food. Food is enjoyable. And I find that like when the clients that I work with, when they really can embrace and enjoy the pleasure of eating, it comes into balance more. There's not, you know, I think, yes, like food is representative of love and care in so many ways. And that's why it gets tangled up and we have disordered eating. But in general, like coming back to sort of a more joyful, easeful relationship with food is sort of what feels best. And we can start children off with that sort of more easeful relationship with food, especially if it's approached that way in the household.
Yeah.
As much as possible. I mean, the culture is just there and there's nothing we can do about our culture. And there's some very toxic influences, but I think we can do our best.
We can. And what about the broccoli situation? So would you, as a mom, like sneak broccoli? I mean, it doesn't have to be broccoli. It might be greens in general, vegetables in general. Would you like sneak that in? Would you encourage the child to find ways of adding stuff to this green vegetable that they might like? Like, I guess everyone's different.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I like to encourage parents to say to children is, you know, when I was little, I didn't like broccoli either, but now I really love it and think it's yummy. Would tonight be a night that you feel like you could try some? And if the kids like puts their arms, you know, across their chest and says, no, you pick your battles. This might not be the night to try something that's like more foreign. But in general, I do think that, you know, trying to like coerce or do a dance or sneak food in doesn't make sense. But definitely continuing to offer it, or like, let's try broccoli with this cheesy sauce on it tonight and see if like putting something that you really like with it makes it taste better to you. You know, I think just like being transparent about we're going to keep trying food, we're going to keep like trying food in different ways, and we're going to sort of create something that is enjoyable on the plate. And you know, it's not always going to work. The child may not like what's served, and it can be so hard. I know this as a parent, like when you've worked hard, you know, to create a meal and nobody likes it. It doesn't feel good, especially if like you put your love into your food. But the reality is they're not rejecting you or your love. They're just rejecting something that feels a little foreign to their palates, and they just may need more exposure and time.
My nephew, who I think he's like, oh my God, I should know how old he is. Maybe he's six, maybe he's five. His favorite food, if you ask him, is raw broccoli. It's so random. And he like when my sister's cutting it up, he'll like go and get literally just some raw broccoli and eat it. It's just so interesting to me. But his body just guided him to liking that. So I think if, I mean, I don't know, but I guess I'm asking you, if we nurture and obviously set appropriate guidelines with our children and also get out of their way, their body will naturally guide them to what it needs. Is that true? So if because our bodies want to be healthy, right? I fully believe that in all forms. So if we're tuned in, we feel like, oh, I feel like a potato, or I feel like some broccoli, or I feel like some chocolate, whatever it is. Children have that ability even more strongly than we do, unless we've done the work to let go of diet culture.
I agree. And I do think that there are going to be times when, like, kids maybe don't gravitate so much towards vegetables because they're And I, you know, you can't, you'd have to measure the individual child on some way, in some scientific way that doesn't make sense. But my thought is that some children are just like going through growth spurts, and it makes sense that maybe they need some heavier, more grounding foods, and vegetables are not it right now. So I think most of the t I mean, I, most of the time, children will have a more varied palate, but they may have particular preferences for whatever reason. And it's hard to know, like, why do some people love mushrooms and some people hate them? Well, it might have to do with their particular body, or maybe some of the culture around those foods growing up, for sure. But I always think that like preferences are kind of interesting. You know, why does that one child gravitate towards broccoli where another child doesn't? Some of that could be just general temperament. Some people are just more adventurous with textures and different things, and some are just more cautious. And I had fraternal twins, so I watched them grow up and just be very different in so many different ways, even though their environment was completely the same. I think preferences are just something that is there, and I think we want to honor our kids' preferences and, like, obviously encourage balance by making lots of different kinds of food available. But we can't force them to eat it, nor should we. So making them available and then staying in our own lane and letting them actually eat the food is really important.
And what about like body movement and exercise then? Because of course, natural, enjoyable body movement is healthy for all of us, no matter how old we are. What if a child doesn't want to go outside? and doesn't want to move their bodies? Like, again, how can we encourage and support that without making it bad and wrong if they're not doing that?
Great question. I think that that's another area where there's lots of temperament difference. Like, some kids are, and I had two girls like that. One of my daughters was like very like movement oriented. She's like always moving. She's like leading backpacking trips right now. That's her. She just loves to be in her body and moving. And my other daughter is just much more naturally inclined to read or hang out on the couch. And like, she's just more chill naturally. And I think we have to honor the different temperaments of different bodies and different personalities for sure. And just make movement a part of family life. So make it fun. Like, you know, both of my daughters have found ways to move that suit them. One of them's backpacking, and the other one likes to go to her like spin classes or whatever at college. So I think that, like, you know, it's just different for different bodies, and just like doing things together as a family and making it fun, getting outside together and encouraging that, especially when you have more influence and the kids are little, I think is a wonderful thing. Bringing kids out into nature when they're in that like early, like wonder kind of stage is a wonderful way to encourage movement in a joyful way, not for the sake of like doing exercise, but for just being in our bodies outside in nature in the fresh air.
A natural place, really. Yeah. What about if someone is listening to this, watching this, and they think that their child has a difficult or challenging relationship with food and exercise? Like, and depending on obviously the age of the child, I'm sure, how would one approach that and then support, and what would the parent do next?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say that reaching out and letting them know that you are concerned is really, really important. I think it's always better to create early intervention when it comes to food and body problems versus like waiting until it's become a more like entrenched pattern. So I think the sooner the better to actually let someone know that you're concerned and potentially bring in some help. Someone who has eating disorders experience, either a psychotherapist or nutrition therapist. Sometimes we start with one versus the other, depending on the orientation. But bringing in a professional who might be able to help. If it's someone who's under 12, usually we work mostly with the parents. But if the child is 12 and up, then the child would be involved in any kind of intervention as well.
Yeah. What about a child who is under 12? I mean, this happened to me. I was diagnosed with anorexia. I think it was actually when I was 12. My mum took a very forceful approach that did save my life, but I hated every part of it because I wanted to rebel against it all. I mean, this is a deeper question, but someone who is around the age of 12 or 13, who is still living with the parents under their roof, who needs to take responsibility in a way to make choices with support to fully recover. And then there's also the aspect of, but they also need that really strong boundaries and rules. I mean, for me, yeah, it worked, but then it didn't work because it took then another 15 years to actually decide to fully recover myself. I don't even know what this question is. Like, how can someone, if someone has a child who's around 12 and they're, let's say, diagnosed with anorexia, or, you know, they're very restrictive eating, what would be the best thing to do in terms of setting those strong rules or giving the child autonomy, I guess, to make the choices themselves?
Yeah, it's a great question. And obviously every family situation is different. But I do think the research shows that if someone is struggling with an eating disorder, if you intervene within the first 3 years, there's better outcomes. In general, that's just research. Obviously, there's like, exceptions all the time. But I think that reaching out and letting the child know that you're concerned and that you're going to keep them safe is really important, however that's done.
Yeah.
And if the child wants to maintain more autonomy around their food, then like they kind of have to earn it by making good choices, and the parents can sort of help them with that. So they may have to be restricted, for example, from sleepovers or things if they don't have dinner, or they might not be able to go to their sports practices if they haven't eaten well that day. So that's where parents can set some boundaries. And then if that doesn't work and it becomes more challenging, then bringing in some other professionals to help with that boundary setting, if it's just not working well with the teen and the parents, can be helpful. It's a tough one because obviously we'd love to keep a young person outside of a hospital setting. We want to keep them in their home environment as much as possible. But we also want to make sure they're not malnourished, because we know that a malnourished brain during that time of life for too long can make it really hard to do that recovery work.
Yeah, that's so true. It's like you say, everyone's different. And like I shared before, I'm glad my mum did force me. At the time, I hated every second of it, but I'm glad she did, because I probably wouldn't even be here by now, in all honesty.
Right.
And don't actually develop fully as women until the age of 25 with our brains and prefrontal cortex and everything, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I find that I've seen an awful lot of college students, because I'm outside of Boston, Massachusetts. And I find that like so many times the eating disorder that they're struggling with has actually been there for some time, and either nobody noticed it or they were very secretive about it. And it's sad because it's become much more entrenched and sort of a part of their identity. The younger parents can intervene and get help for someone who's struggling, the better.
Yeah. And then lastly, Heidi, sorry, I have one of my dog hairs on my face. And you know, when you can't, I can see it actually under on my nose, like flying around. If a parent has a poor relationship with food and their body, and they're perhaps listening to this because they're on their own journey and they have children, and they're realizing that, oh shit, like I've probably passed on some of my behaviors around food and their body onto them. Of course they're only human, but would you then recommend the parents share with, again, depending on how old the children are, share with the children like what's going on for them, for the parent, and the journey the parent is on to food freedom? Like how much would you involve the children in the parents' recovery to support the ongoing development of children around their food relationship?
Yeah, well, it sort of depends on the developmental age of the child, right? It's not appropriate for children to know all the details of their parents' own recovery and growth work. But if there are some things that are being noticed, if a child is imitating some of the food behaviors, for example, of the parent, it's okay for the parent to say, I'm actually struggling with that myself, and I don't want you to do like I'm doing. I'm actually having a really hard time with this, and I'm getting some help for it. I had a client who, it's a vignette that I wrote about in the book, where the parent really wasn't aware that their 9-year-old knew that they were purging. But yet the 9-year-old like said something like, oh, my mom eats ice cream and then throws it all up. And she was just like, so, like surprised by that knowledge that her young person had about her behavior, that she went right up to, her child and said, that's not normal. Like, that's not something that is okay to do. And mommy is getting some help for that right now. And it was important. It was an important intervention.
Yeah. Yeah, wow, thank you. So, Heidi, is there anything that I've not asked you that you would like to share about your services, your book, any words of wisdom?
Well, you've had some great questions, I have to say, Victoria. So I appreciate this conversation so much. I can tell you and your listeners that they can find my book. It's Nurture, How to Raise Kids Who Love Food, Their Bodies, and Themselves. And you can find it on my website, which is anourishingword.com. So it's anourishingword.com. It's also available at bookshop.org and Amazon and all the other places that books are available. And please ask for it if you don't see it, because it is available to all bookstores and libraries. I also write a newsletter biweekly, every other week, called Nourishing Words, which is on Substack. So that's another place where, if people want to check out my writing a little bit first, or just get some sort of free inspiration, that's available as well.
That's awesome, Heidi. And how do you work? Do you work with clients one-to-one or in a group basis? Like, how do you support people?
I do. I do one-to-one counseling, both in person and over Zoom, like we're talking here. And I do groups. Right now I've put like my groups on hold because I'm promoting my book and doing a little book touring, but I do therapeutic book clubs, which means that we read books together around this topic and talk about them. It's like, it's part of the support network for people that are in recovery. So that's one of the fun things I really enjoy doing. So I think that come summer or fall, I'm going to start up another therapeutic book club. And I have a couple of authors who are willing to join me for like the last session of the book club. So it's kind of like a fun thing to do,
Oh,
to have the author come and talk as well.
Yeah. Well, I'll obviously link everything below, Heidi, so everyone can access your links easily. And thank you for being here. Thank you for your time. And yeah. Anything else you'd like to share?
No, thank you so much for having me. This has been a nice conversation. I really appreciate it.
Of course, you are welcome. Much love to you.